Well, you know, I was looking at my files, and the last time I talked to you, it was in the fall of 1985.
Wow. Doesn't seem like 7 years ago, does it?
That was on the occasion of Home Before Dark.
We talked about, are we on the air? We talked about your apartment. I remember your apartment.
My apartment?
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Every time I drive by that building, I think.
Which building?
The building where you live, on Central Park West, up high.
Oh, well.
Back a block.
The what?
You're back a block on Central Park West.
Oh, boy, you do remember. Wow,
no,
wow,
Joe.
Wow,
I even remember what you paid for
it. Columbus Avenue.
Yeah.
How much did I pay back in 1985?
Oh, it was, you know, $287 or something. Yeah. Am I close?
Yeah, I think probably I paid about that. It's still under.
That's what sticks in my memory.
Yeah, it's still under $600.
True New Yorker, the real estate, right?
Yeah, they let the building go down a lot because they're all
How
these
sad.
All these seven buildings are being converted to condos.
Oh, they are?
So some of the buildings are beautiful. I mean, they have the marble lobbies and the uniform concierge. And my building, we put a coat of paint on in the hallways occasionally, but they're waiting until they get enough resources together to convert it to a condo status.
But that might not happen now.
Maybe it won't. I'm not sure I would buy anyway. I mean, we're a stabilized tenant, a non-eviction plan.
Oh, right. You shouldn't, yeah. Particularly not now.
Yeah, because it's...
You've got all those things, the Key West and all those other things right up there.
Yeah, all these
too.
New buildings. Great restaurants around there now.
Yeah. Are those kind of...
Because you live nearby, don't you?
No, I live on the other side of the park, but in 1985 I had just moved. Maybe I hadn't even moved yet. I think I had moved. I'm trying to think. I moved... Home Before Dark came out in the fall, and I moved in the spring. So I don't know whether we talked while I was still living on Central Park West or...
I think you were living on the west side. It just seems...
Well, I moved back to the east side, but now I'm moving again, but I don't know to where.
Why are you moving?
Because I sold my apartment.
Why?
I don't like it.
Oh, you don't like it? Not because it was a great deal.
No, it was a terrible deal. Terrible deal. Terrible deal.
You want to stay in Manhattan?
I don't know. I have to decide before June. I mean, I have two little kids and two dogs and a husband who works at home. And He works at home? Yeah. And it's
what does he think? What does he want to do?
He wants to move to California where he comes from and lives.
Uh-huh.
But I don't want to move to California, so we'll see.
Why don't you go to Wichita, Kansas?
Right, Nevada.
Well, let's talk about the treetops.
Okay.
This is kind of a companion piece to Home Before Dark because it focuses primarily on your mother and your mother's side of the family. And, of course, we know about your father and his prominence, but up until now I didn't know very much about your mother's side, and it turns out that you had a number of prominent members of your family, including grandfathers and great-grandfathers. Tell me a little bit about them.
Well, you know, long before my father was famous, he was thrilled to be accepted into a family in which there were other famous men. My great-grandfather, both these men are fabulous characters, was Alexander Graham Bell's assistant, and they invented the telephone together. They were a couple of kids, and everyone kept saying to them, you know, you're working on a crazy idea, you know, work on the telegraph or the harmonic telegraph, but they kept at it. And
you better mention the assistant's name.
Thomas Watson. Oh, right, my great-grandfather. I just think of him as my great-grandfather.
Nobody will forget those immortal words. Come here, Mr. Watson, I need you.
Well, that was the great thing. When I started writing this book, the first wonderful thing that happened was I went out to Bell Labs, where Thomas Watson's correspondence and Bell's correspondence are all very neatly kept. I mean, they have great archives. And I found, you know, reading through everything, that the famous incident where Bell spills the acid on his hand and says, Watson, come here, I want you, or Mr. Watson, come here, was actually never happened, that my great-grandfather Watson had made that up 50 years after the fact, and that at the time of the so-called invention of the telephone, which was in, 1897, I hope, there wasn't any acid. And, in fact, Watson complained bitterly that such an important moment should have been so ordinary and undramatic, right? And he wrote all these letters saying, you know, it's too bad. If only we'd known what was going to happen that night, we would have made up a better story. So what happened was Bell died 50 years past, and then when Thomas Watson sat down to write his own memoirs, he just couldn't bear it. So he made up the story that should have happened. He made up a story about battery acid and a shout for help. And it was such a good story that, I mean, this is really about the life of a good story, that everyone picked it up, and it's become part of American history. But it's not true. There wasn't any battery acid. There wasn't any shout for help.
Well, your great-grandfather Watson became a very successful man in his own right and did something that has become a legacy for your family, the creation of a summer place called Treetops. Tell me about that.
Right, right. Well, Grandpa Watson then proceeded, my family, the men in my family, and it's not really the men I want to talk about, and it's not really the men that I wrote about, are all very much self-inventions. They all these three men, my great-grandfather, my grandfather, and my father, all came from very humble or difficult origins, and they all made up personalities for themselves, which they then pursued. And Watson was a populist, a socialist. And after he and Bell invented the telephone, he became very rich, I mean, millions and millions and millions of dollars, and he decided to build a shipyard. And it was during the Depression of the 1890s in Massachusetts. So he employed as many men as he possibly could. He joked that it would have been cheaper to pension off every able-bodied man in the state of Massachusetts. And in the end, the shipyard went bust, and Watson lost almost all his money. So he went from being one of the richest men in the country to being fairly well off. Bell had made him set aside a little emergency fund, and that's what indeed he lived on the rest of his life. And with some of that emergency fund, he bought this hillside in New Hampshire and built, with my grandfather, then his son-in-law, built a summer place. And I think what both of these men had in mind in their different ways was that they would create a family dynasty, that they would create a family so that the members of their family would not have to invent themselves the way they had invented themselves, that there would be a real family.
And Treetops was constructed so that there was a stone house and then a number of guest houses
right
in the around
well, it. It's very funny because there are really two parts of Treetops, the top of the hill and the bottom of the hill. And my Grandpa Watson, being a socialist, built these very simple cabins with open stud walls. And my grandfather Winternitz, who at that point was the dean of Yale Medical School, had much fancier tastes. So you go, you know, going from a cabin at the top of the hill down to the stone house, which is very elegant, is like passing from one tier of society to another, even though it's a distance of maybe, you know, 100 yards. So it was built by these two men, and you can see even now there are two different styles. They're very different styles.
Now, before we get on to your mother and her sisters, we ought to talk about your grandfather, because he also was a very prominent and rather unusual
right.
man from
right.
Baltimore.
Right. Well, my grandfather and my great-grandfather and my father were all extraordinary men, and I actually at one point wanted to subtitle this book Three Great Men and the Women They Destroyed, because when I started looking at my mother's life, and then which led me to her mother's life, I saw that the women who supported, nurtured, stood by these men paid a terrible price, and that the men were not happy to have them pay that price, but sort of took that in stride. And my grandfather was, again, a poor man, for a lower middle class family who he didn't like much. And like my father and my great-grandfather, he at some point decided that he was, you know, an illegitimate prince who had been dumped into this uninteresting family by mistake. I mean, he didn't really think that, but that was the attitude these men had towards the families in which they were born, that somehow they came from some kind of spiritual royalty. And in every case, they left their families behind as fast as they could. My grandfather was an academic and scientific genius. He graduated, put himself through Johns Hopkins Medical School, was sent to Yale as dean in 19, in the 1920s when Yale Medical School barely existed. It was a bunch of shacks. You know, they had 50 students culled from 60 applicants. Most of the faculty had quit or been transferred out, and they were about to close the medical school down. And
but he was the first non-Yale and the first Jew to head the medical
school. First non-Yale and the first Jew, and he just went in there like a cyclone. And within 5 years, it had become one of the, you know, medical schools in the country that everyone wanted to go to. He tripled the endowment. He changed the whole curriculum. He changed the whole curriculum of medical school in a way that is still being taught. I mean, he just was able to... He was the most incredibly effective human being I've ever come in contact with. You know, he was able to take this moribund medical school and make it into something really exciting and really rich and really sought after and really wonderful.
Where can he be now that CBS needs him?
I don't know.
Now, your mother, she also went to medical school, but I have a feeling, as you kind of alluded to a moment ago, that... Well, your grandma. I said your mother.
Right.
I mentioned your grandmother. The thing that is significant with regard to the women in your family is that the men were so domineering.
Right.
That they, of course, it was a different era too, where women were always took a secondary and a family role.
Well, sure, but I think that men tend to be domineering. And women have a choice. They can either fight back and spend their energies in a lifelong struggle, or they can live alone, or they can give in and try to lead some kind of autonomous but secret life. You know, I don't, in a lot of ways, things haven't changed. I mean, what happened to my grandmother is not the worst story, but it's a terrible story, and I think a typical story. She had fought very hard to go to college. Her parents didn't want her to go to college. And then she had seen her brothers die of childhood diseases, so she wanted to go to medical school, and her parents didn't want that either, but she fought and fought and fought, and they finally let her. She went to Hopkins. She got a degree in 1907, when there are very few women with medical degrees, and then she fell in love with her professor, and that was her mistake, you know. And you can see... They got married. Her professor was my grandfather, of course, the great Milton Charles Winters. They got married, and her father sent them on a tour around the world for their honeymoon. And I found the passport that they took with them. And in those days, there weren't passports. It was more like a letter of, you know, introduction, this huge thing from the United States government. And it was made out to Dr. Milton Charles Winters and wife. So she was already... No longer Helen Watson, Dr. Helen Watson, all the other things she was, when they went on their honeymoon. And then they came back, and she never got to practice medicine. He went back to work at Hopkins. She had three children in 3 years. He then got his job at Yale. He moved up to Yale. She moved the whole household up to Yale. She was pregnant. She had two more children, a miscarriage, and then she got sick, and then she died. So she never got to do any of the things.
Yeah, she did die prematurely. Well, she gave birth to your mother, Mary, who was also a very interesting woman, and who had a very strong literary bent. I guess that is perhaps why she was attracted to John Cheever.
I don't know if that's why she was attracted to him, but I guess, of course, you're right. She, most of her family were scientists, my grandfather, and she... really alone among them, cared tremendously about literature and words and poetry. Thomas Watson actually had a kind of literary streak. Not only did he make the story about the acid, but he wrote endless religious tracts. He was a great believer in the spiritual life, and she inherited some of that, or maybe it just, you know, who knows why people are the way they are, but she was a poet. Went to Sarah Lawrence, studied poetry, and yes, I think that one of the reasons why she fell in love with my father was because she was able to value what he did. Because certainly at the time he wasn't famous or successful, but she was able to see how good he was.
You came along in the mid-40s, and Treetops was a summer place for you. What was it like in those days?
Well, it was wonderful and complicated. you know, if you can imagine four generations of any family having to coexist on a rather small plot of land, well, just let your imagination run wild. It was everything you thought. It was just
for the summer, though.
Well, yes, but it was summer after summer after summer. So, you know, you would fall in love with one cousin and then come back the next summer to find that he was in love with someone else, and then come back the third next summer to find that he was a junkie, and then come back the next summer to find that he was married. And, you know, I mean, there's a kind of progression, a kind of same time next year progression that you have with people who you've seen for 40 years.
Yeah, we should probably point out that your grandfather, after your grandmother's death, remarried, and he married a member of the Whitney family. So there were two separate families.
There. Right, right. So there were a lot of cousins. That was one of the, I don't want to say trauma, but that was certainly one of the big events of my mother's life. The first terrible thing that happened was her mother dying when she was 12, and then quite quickly, Winter, as her father was called, then the dean of Yale, remarried a woman who couldn't have been more different. From my mother's real mother. She was a wonderful, full-blown society broad, you know, tireless charity worker, member of every club that counted, friends with every person who counted. And she had four children who were very tall, very beautiful, very aristocratic, and what happened was that the four Whitney children and the five Winternitz children, who were Jewish, intellectual, dedicated to the proposition that science was God, were all moved into the same household. And what resulted was a lot of hurt feelings. Really a war. It was really a children's war. And it mostly went on at treetops because quite quickly, Winter realized that things weren't working. You know, a lot of children were sent away to school. The Whitney children were already at school. No, one of them wasn't, but three of them were. And, you know, the Winternitz children felt that they had been moved in on by these rather snotty instant siblings. And the Whitney children, who knows what they felt? They're much too much too classy, much too well-bred to really say. But I
think... Well, it's obvious in reading your book, Treetops, that you weren't close to many of the... I think you interviewed two of the Whitneys in your research, but in general, I get the impression that you weren't too close to that side.
Well, I am now, but a lot of generations have passed. I think the Whitneys, my Aunt Janie says, the Whitneys had been used to going to Watch Hill and Bar Harbor, where there were lots of other children like them, and lots of sailing and lots of parties, and they thrived on these very social summers, and all of a sudden their mother married this dean, and they found themselves in the middle of New Hampshire picking vegetables in a kind of... Treetops was run like a work camp.
Now, I was going to say, you ought to talk a little bit about the regimentation of the kids.
Well, that came from my Grandpa Watson, who felt that, you know, labor, the manual labor that he had to do as a child did him so much good that he wanted his children and grandchildren to have the same advantage, but... It was not a fancy place, Treetops. They practically wore uniforms. They all wore homemade middies with matching bloomers, and in the morning they all went out to the vegetable garden, and they had what they called the human rototiller, which was the five children crawling along on their hands and knees with their father behind them yelling. you know, so it wasn't anything like Watch Hill or Bar Harbor. And when the Whitney children got there, as a result of their mother marrying Winter, they were horrified. I mean, can you imagine, you know, going from wearing pretty dresses and going to sailing parties to having to pick the vegetables and dig in the dirt, and, you know, they had to do all the canning, they had to kill the chickens and put up the chickens. I mean, they had to do the hard work of running what was then a working farm.
Now, as the years went on, Susan, where did your father, John, fit in all of this?
Well, he fell in love with Treetops and with my mother simultaneously. I think, as I said, he had left his own family quite definitely behind. And he went up to Treetops with my mother before they were married, and he fell in love with the whole thing. He fell in love with Winter, who, like my father, was short and feisty, but who was extremely successful. And as my father pointed out, that was inspirational for him to see that someone who didn't play by the rules could be so successful. And he fell in love with Polly Whitney, Winter's wife, who was, as I say, a great society dame. And the whole place, the whole idea of a family place, he just loved it. He just loved it.
As the years passed, what kind of relationship developed between your mother and your father?
Well, my parents were so strange. Like anyone, like any couple, I guess, who were married 40 years, there were different phases. And I think that as, particularly in the 60s, when my father was drinking a lot, their marriage had some very unpleasant times.
Were you, as children, aware of this?
Oh, sure. They would, typically, you know, my father would take me aside and say, you know, this just can't go on. I have to divorce your mother. Could you find me a lawyer? This is when I was living in New York, and I would say, sure, you know, and then my mother would take me aside and say, I have to have a lawyer, you know, this can't go on. And so I would locate a lawyer and...
For which one?
For one or the other or both. And, at one point, I had a friend who was a lawyer, and I said to him, look, would you just come out to the house and talk to them? And so the lawyer came out to the house, and there were my parents. There was my mother sitting on my father's lap on the porch, giggling like a girl. And, you know, they just couldn't have been more in love. So they were very volatile. Just at the point when you thought they were going to finally get divorced, it would turn out that they'd be the best of friends.
Do you think that...
And vice versa.
You think the major problem in their relationship was your father's drinking?
Well...
Or just their personalities?
It's hard to say, you know, it's hard to say. 40 years is such a long time.
Of course, he didn't drink heavily all of those 40 years, did he?
Well, sure he did. It only caught up with him. I mean, I think you can drink pretty heavily till you're, say, 55.
That's scary.
Don.
Wish you wouldn't have said that.
you know, eventually it catches up with you. It didn't really catch up with him until he was in his 50s. And then it caught up with him in a hurry. But also, those were different times. Everybody drank a lot. You know, it wasn't... Even 15 years ago, it wasn't thought bizarre to have a couple of martinis at lunch. Now you have a couple of martinis at lunch and... So he was just drinking the way everyone else appeared to be drinking until, well, the late 60s, and suddenly he was very sick. Even when he had his first heart attack, it wasn't clear to everyone that it was about alcohol, because it seemed so normal for a writer of his age to be drinking a lot. I don't know. I certainly think his drinking didn't help his marriage.
Now, your father's alleged, reported, but your father reported love affairs, both homosexual and heterosexual. What did that do to the relationship with Mary? And was she aware of it?
Well, yeah. I think he was very public about it.
Public?
Well, he was very public about his affairs with women, which was certainly partly meant to camouflage his affairs with men, right? In other words, if someone goes around saying, I have seven mistresses, then you might not so quickly think that they were gay, right? So he was very public about his mistresses, and the best thing my mother ever did was when she would go up to Treetops, after he had decided he didn't like Treetops, which took about 20 years. I mean, it's hard to talk about their lives because it's such a huge span, you know, and to telescope it into one conversation makes it sound nutty. But if you think about what happens to you over a 10 or 20 or 30 year period, you can see that, you know, you change a lot. So my mother would go up to Treetops every summer without my father. He would refuse to go. And before she would go, starting about 2 or 3 months before she would go, he would throw a major temper tantrum. I mean, it was very clear that he had some male fear, some very real fear of abandonment, you know, that even if he wasn't, even if they weren't getting along, this was so threatening to him, the idea that his wife should take off, for it was usually 2 or 3 weeks, and go stay with her own family, just was terribly upsetting. But of course, instead of admitting he was upset and afraid, he got angry, right, as men do. And so there would be 2 or 3 months of temper tantrums, you know, with him saying, well, I guess your mother certainly doesn't care about the family, or she wouldn't be leaving me like this. And a lot of your mother is leaving me, you know, your mother will be abandoning me in June, and who knows what will happen to me then. And my mother, instead of telling him to take a powder, which I certainly think she would have been, would conscientiously cook and freeze 2 weeks' worth of meals, right? She would do everything she could. She would get the house clean. She would make sure there was going to be someone around. She would get him invited to nice dinner parties with people she thought he liked. I mean, she did everything. She would call him every day.
He made her feel guilty.
It didn't make any difference. You know, there's one thing in the book. I would go over there every now and then because I worried about him. I mean, after all this fuss, when she wasn't there, you never knew what he was going to do. First, he would usually break the oven, then he'd fill the sink full of dirty dishes. Then, I mean, the messes he made. Anyway, I went over there one afternoon and I found that one of these frozen dinners, right, he hadn't read the instructions. So he'd put it in the oven at 500. He always put everything in the oven at 500. And then he would take it out and scrape off the cooked part and eat the cooked part and put the rest back in the oven, right? I mean, it was so pathetic and so unnecessary. Anyway, this happened year after year after year, and he got to my mother. You know, I mean, I think often she would have liked to have spent more time up there. And then he would always, right before she came back, he would clean the house, and she would come back, and then he would wonder why she wasn't grateful that he'd cleaned the house. I mean, marriages are so complicated, but so simple. Anyway, at one point he had been teaching in Iowa, and he was very, very pleased with himself because he had at that point, I guess, 2 mistresses. And one of them was a young girl who was just, according to him, hopelessly in love with him. And every day she wrote him love letters. And, you know, the clear implication was that she loved him in ways that his family just was inadequate to love him. And he talked incessantly about not about the girl particularly, but about how much she loved him. And this started around Christmas, and this went on all spring. And then, you know, my mother said she would be going to Treetops in June, and my father started in with the temper tantrum. And my mother called the girl, and she said, listen, you know, we haven't met, but I know you're a friend of John's, and I'm going away for 2 weeks in June, and he doesn't like to stay alone, so could you come and take care of him? And this young girl was delighted, of course. She said, well, I'd love to, right? And, of course, that was the end of her relationship with my father. I mean, my father was very upset. My mother had called his bluff. Of course, the last thing he wanted was to have this girl taking care of him in his own house. And I have to say, we all cheered.
Treetops still exist as part of the family.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Do you go there, take your kids
mm-hmm.
there?
I was there last summer. I'll be there again this summer. You know, the roof on the stone house is leaking. I mean, life goes on. There's a new porch on Apple. No, it's all...
It's in a perpetual trust?
It's in a perpetual trust, which isn't big enough. But, but yeah, it's pretty well protected. I mean, nobody can sell and nobody can, you know, it's... fortunately... It's never been tremendously valuable, I think, and that has kept at least kept the family from fighting about whether or not it should be sold. Had my great grandfather bought that many acres on, say, Nantucket, I think that the family, you know, that there would have been pressure to sell it.
Now, there is a postscript to Treetops, and it's contained in the end of your memoir, and that's after your father's death, there was an attempt by a small publishing house in Chicago, Academy Chicago, to publish his uncollected short stories, and that led to the lawsuit. Well, what's the latest on that? What happened?
Well, that lawsuit is still going on. It's just been endless. I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about it or not, but what happened was there were 68 stories that they had been collected in, my father, I think, had 6 or 7 collections of stories during his lifetime. So of these 68 stories, some of them had been in these small collections, some of them hadn't, some of them had just appeared in magazines. None of them had been in the big red book, the so-called collected stories of John Cheever. It wasn't even called collected. And, you know, in, I guess it was 1987, a small publisher, Academy Chicago, and came to my mother and asked if they could do a small edition of a few of my father's stories. And she said yes. And then it turned out that they were planning to publish 68 of my father's stories in a large edition. And she said, please, no, you know, that's not what I agreed to.
Well, I understand these were some very early and rather primitive stories that he may not have wanted published.
They vary. You know, I think he never wanted to publish anything from the past. He never wanted to publish the original Red collection of stories of John Cheever. Bob Gottlieb, who was his editor at Knopf, had to persuade him that it was a good idea to republish those stories. My father never looked back. You know, he had a fear of looking back. So, you know, he certainly didn't want any of these stories published, but you can say, well, perhaps he was wrong. I think it turned out in the stories of John Cheever he was wrong. I think that these 68 stories, they start in the 20s and 30s, but some of them are from the 60s. In other words, they span the whole career, and I think that if they were to be published, they would have to be published with a lot of explanation. In other words, some of them are really just fragments. Some of them are, you know, from the days when he thought he was a communist, you know, and they talk about the sound of the Internationale echoing through the land, you know. Some of them are really studies for other stories. I mean, there are a lot of different things, and in a way, these 68 stories are fascinating because you can see his apprenticeship in them, and you can see some of them are amazingly good. In other words, even when he was in his 20s, he could toss off a story that just takes your breath away, even though it's a 4-page story. But then, you know, a month later, he would write a real clunker. So it's very interesting to watch him learn how to write and watch him cultivate his gift.
Well, I really would like to read that. I mean, I'm sorry this got tied up.
Well, I think we may publish it. But certainly, Academy Chicago had in mind publishing it as if it were, you know, without explanation. I mean, if it's to be published, somebody has to say, you know, this is a story that was written in 19...
It should be a different book than what they...
It has to be a completely different book. It has to be, you know, very carefully dated and annotated so that you don't... You know, if you open the book and you read the first story, I mean, it's not at all like what you think of as a John Cheever story. It's a story written by a very young man who was groping for his style, you know, taking a little from Hemingway and a little from Faulkner and a little from, you know, pamphlets and a little from this and a little from that. But that, in a way, those stories are fascinating. I mean, I just found them. At one point, we had to actually produce a book for Academy Chicago of 15 stories, and I wrote an introduction to them. That book, Academy Chicago, has declined to publish that book. But as a result, I studied a lot of these stories, and it's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. To me as a writer, it was so fascinating. And I tell you, there are stories, there are little fragments that prove once and for all that talent has nothing to do with character. I mean, you know, here was this guy, young guy, it took him a long time to even know what he was doing, to even know what he could do. I mean, they're really interesting, those apprentice stories.
Well, us Cheever fans and literary types like myself, I know, I mean, I would lust. Yeah. I would be the first one to buy that book. So,
well, I think we've decided as a family that they do have to be published,
But how?
It probably has to. Well, we just have to annotate them.
I'm sure you're going to have that situation in Chicago resolved.
Well, that is still going on.
Here's your mother in her 70s trying to deal with
this.
It's a nightmare.
And we won in federal court, and then we won in state court, and then we won in appeals court, and now we're in the Supreme Court in Illinois. And I think this is the last appeal they have, but, you know, every judge fines for us. But it's been going on for 3 years, and it's cost more than $500,000.
I want to wrap things up, Susan Cheever. In addition to your memoirs, of course, you have your own fiction that you work on.
You've written,
I think, four novels, haven't you?
Five. And I'm halfway through another.
So it's a literary family. Mary Cheever is a poet. She's had a couple of volumes of poetry and other things. So it's.
And my brother Ben has written a novel too.
I think your brother was the editor of the Collected Letters.
That's right.
And now
he's finishing a novel. So we're going to be a dynasty.
And when are you going back to Treetops?
Well, I'll probably go in June or July.
Nice talking to you, Susan. Thank you very much.
Nice to see you, Don.